WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The more you know about why foods behave the way they do, the science of cooking, the more you will understand about how to prepare a good food. That's the premise of Harold McGee's book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. It was first published in 1984 and was described in Time magazine as a minor masterpiece. L.A. Times food columnist Russ Parson calls it the single best book in its field, and Vogue magazine food critic Jeffrey Steingarten says it changed the way we cooks think about and do things in the kitchen. Now McGee has written a new edition that includes the latest information about the science of cooking, takes into account new food trends, and explains the chemistry of flavor and taste. We played part one of my interview with McGee before the holidays. Now we'll hear part two. He says that most of what we perceive as flavor really comes from our sense of smell. I asked him to explain that, since I perceive taste as coming from my tongue, not my nose. He told me it's really a matter of numbers.
We have receptors on our tongue that can detect a half dozen or so different kinds of molecules. And so we have a half dozen or so different kinds of sensations that come from the tongue. Sweetness, sourness, bitterness, umami, a Japanese term that refers to the flavor, very specific taste of MSG, monosodium glutamate. In the nose, though, we've got hundreds of different receptors that can detect thousands of different kinds of molecules. And so the tongue, in a way, kind of lays down the basis for a flavor in a food, gives you kind of the backbone of the flavor. But then the complications and the distinctiveness comes from the hundreds of compounds that are responsible for the aroma.
Even when there isn't a discernible aroma from what we're eating?
Well, there's a difference between what you can smell by sniffing a food on your plate and what you can smell from the aromas that come from inside your mouth across your olfactory receptors in the nose from inside. Of course, the mouth is a very enclosed place, and so things can get concentrated there, whereas if it's sitting on your plate, you know, the aromas are going in all directions, and you may only get a tiny fraction of what's available.
In your book, you say that an exception to the rule that much of our taste really comes from our sense of smell, an exception to that is hot spices like hot peppers. How do we sense them?
Chili peppers actually activate not a taste receptor, but a receptor that's really responsible for creating the sensation of pain. And that's a very peculiar thing that human beings have come to enjoy and treasure and seek after flavors that actually do cause us pain, and do that because they're meant to deter us from eating. The other thing is that apparently the compounds that cause those sensations also heighten our sensitivity to certain other tastes. So, for example, saltiness and sourness become much more pronounced in the presence of the compounds that give hot peppers their heat.
While we're talking about aroma, it seems to me that the place that's really using the latest knowledge about aroma and how that enhances taste is the fast food industry. Because aren't they really chemically studying that and consciously using chemicals that literally enhance fragrance and also enhance taste?
Yes, one of the driving forces to understanding about more about flavor has been a desire to not exactly make better foods, but to approximate them by other means. So instead of making, say, a traditional cheddar cheese the old-fashioned way, which is very labor-intensive and takes months of aging in order to develop the flavor, cheese companies are interested in knowing, well, what are those flavors that are in the final cheese that give it its wonderful qualities, and can we get them in there some other way faster?
Do you know what chemically is going on in the flavor of cheddar cheese and how you can chemically enhance cheese to make it taste like a good cheddar?
Well, the way cheese and many other traditional slowly made and especially fermented foods get their flavor is essentially from the breakdown of the original food materials. So, for example, in the case of cheddar cheese, it's made from milk, and milk is mainly fat and protein. And those molecules in themselves don't really have flavor. They're way too big. They don't. They can't escape into the air and affect our sense of smell. What happens in the course of cheese making is that various microbes, mostly bacteria in the case of cheddar cheese, break those flavorless kind of precursor molecules down into their building blocks, amino acids and fatty acids and things like that. And it's those things that then interact with each other and with our senses of taste and smell and give us the impression of a kind of mouth-filling flavor. And the way to get that quickly is to find ways to accelerate that breakdown or to add those small, flavorsome molecules from the very beginning so that you don't have to wait.
Your book explained a lot to me about how fruits ripen and why I sometimes am lucky and sometimes not with that. Can you explain the difference between the two different types of fruit and how they ripen?
Yeah, there are two basic kinds of fruit that we deal with, one of which ripens in a kind of explosive way almost, or a very pronounced way. And those are fruits that just kind of sit there and look like nothing in particular, and then all of a sudden begin to change color and develop aroma. Pears are a good example. Bananas are a good example. Peaches and nectarines and berries and so on have a very short lifespan, and we have to catch them at their peak. They're very good for a very short period of time. Before that, they're not really very interesting. After that, they're just kind of over the hill and not very nice. Then there's another kind of fruit which really doesn't go through that. It ripens very slowly and reaches a kind of plateau and is fine for days, sometimes weeks. And citrus fruits are the best example of those. Apples also keep very well.
And one of the differences between the way the two different types of fruit ripen is ethylene.
That's right. Ethylene is a gas given off by plant cells under various circumstances. Often it's a response to stress or to wounding, and basically speeds up the metabolism of other cells in the neighborhood. And it's very important in ripening because it helps trigger the kind of rapid transformation that we see in fruits that ripen that way. So, for example, if you have a fruit that should ripen that way, a pear or a peach or something like that, and you really want it to go a little faster, you can enclose it in something like a paper bag with, say, a banana that's well along in its ripening because it's giving off ethylene and it can help nudge the other fruit along in its process.
So how is the food industry using this knowledge of ethylene and how it affects ripening? And how is that in turn affecting the taste of our fruits?
Well, it has allowed them to essentially ripen fruits on demand in the supermarket or in transit to the supermarket. So they can therefore pick fruit from the tree or the vine before it's physiologically ripe, before it's actually ripened on its own, transport it while it's still relatively firm and not as fragile as it is when it's ripe, and then either in the truck or at the supermarket, dose it with some ethylene gas to induce ripening now that it's reached its destination. That's very handy for the producer and for the supermarket. It's not so great for the consumer because it means that the fruit has been harvested before it ripened on the vine or the tree, and that means that it's had less time to generate sugars, it's had less time to generate flavor, and it just doesn't taste as good.
My guest is Harold McGee. He's written a new, updated, revised version of his book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Harold McGee, and he has a new edition of his popular book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. I don't know if you cook much with microwaves, but what's the difference between how a microwave oven cooks and your stove, and why is it that you can't, or at least I can't, brown food in a microwave, and the food often comes out dry?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if it's, like a fish or a meat or something, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and vegetables, too. Microwaves cook in a very different way than ordinary ovens do. Ordinary ovens basically heat the air inside them and radiate heat from their walls and the floor and the ceiling of the oven. And that heat then gets transferred to the outside surface of the food that you put in the oven. And then it gets transferred from the surface of the food to the interior. So the food itself conducts heat from the outside to the inside, and that's the process of cooking. The microwave oven acts very differently. It's sending out electromagnetic radiation, and that radiation turns out to affect really, for the most part, only the water molecules in the food. It really doesn't affect the other molecules, the proteins and the carbohydrates. So what happens is that the electromagnetic radiation from the oven strikes the outside of the food and actually penetrates about an inch into the food before it's dissipated, heats the water molecules in that part of the food, and then the water molecules have to transfer their heat to the other parts of the food. So if a food doesn't have much in the way of water, then it doesn't heat very well. And in fact, if it has water but the water is immobilized, for example, in ice, then it doesn't heat very well. So you can take an ice cube and put it in a microwave oven and turn it on, and nothing much will happen for a long time until the outside begins to melt a little bit just from the warmth of the air. And then the microwaves can affect those water molecules, and then they will begin to affect the rest of the ice cube. The reason that microwave ovens don't brown foods very well is that the microwaves basically affect the water content of the food. And the thing about browning is that it really doesn't begin to happen, those reactions that generate wonderful flavors and colors, until most of the water is boiled off of the surface of the food. And that really never happens in the microwave, or it takes really extended microwave cooking in order to get there. And by the time you've done that, you've turned the food into something like shoe leather.
What do you do to compensate for all the dryness that can result from a microwave oven?
So you can pulse the energy, and that means using a lower power level, and then the microwave is only on for 10 or 15 seconds and then off for 10 or 15 seconds and then on again, and that gives the heat a chance to migrate from the surface to the center and to even out. The other thing you can do is make the atmosphere of the cooking chamber moist. So that, and that does two things. It provides more water molecules for the microwaves to work on and generate heat for the food. And then it provides moisture in the air right around the food so that the food doesn't lose as much water to the air. And so you simply take the care to put a few tablespoons of water into the dish that you're doing the cooking in, and then cover the dish either with another dish or a plate or kind of loose plastic wrap, and that retains the moisture and prevents it from drying out.
Do you use the microwave for defrosting?
I generally don't use the microwave for defrosting.
Is it bad? I mean, does it dry out food in the defrosting process more than just leaving it out would?
Well, yeah, the problem with defrosting is, again, the microwaves are most efficient on water molecules that are free to move. And in fact, that's the way they heat the food, is by making those water molecules that are free to move faster. So in something that's frozen, the water molecules are actually locked up in crystals and are not free to move. And that's why microwaving an ice cube doesn't get you very far. when things do start to melt, then things happen faster. And of course, that's going to happen primarily in a frozen food at the surface. And so what ends up happening often in defrosting is that you, in a microwave, is that you end up partly cooking the very outside while the rest of the food simply thaws. And so you end up with a very uneven result. So I prefer, when it comes to defrosting, to which can take forever in the refrigerator, for example, is just to put the food in a container of ice water. And even though you might think that the warming up is going to be slow because the water is icy, in fact, the water is very efficient at moving heat in and out of various things. It's fluid and it has a high heat capacity and so on. So it actually is a very effective and rapid way of thawing a food, and also thawing it safely, that is to say, keeping the surface at a temperature that isn't going to allow for the growth of bacteria while the rest of the food warms up.
We're warned about a lot of foods having bacteria, so if it's not cooked thoroughly, we'll get food poisoning, and if we don't wash our hands thoroughly after handling it, we can get sick. You hear that particularly discussed around fresh chicken and certain fresh meats. What kind of foods do you feel like you need to take precautions around?
Well, it really is the fresh meats and poultry in particular, because we eat poultry with the skin on, or at least it's packaged much of the time with the skin on, and the skin is going to have the heaviest burden of bacteria of any part of the food. A piece of meat that comes from a healthy animal is going to have its interior is going to be essentially sterile. The interior of the muscle is not going to have any bacteria. The bacteria come from the processing of the meat, and it usually almost exclusively resides on the surface of the food. And that's why it's really important when you're handling food to be careful of both the food surface and any other surfaces that come into contact with it. So the cutting board, the knife, your hands. And also, you should be aware that when you cut food up, that you're introducing bacteria from the surface to whatever surface it is you're cutting. So it is just a good idea whenever you're making cooked foods of any kind to make sure that at least the surface of the food gets cooked to the boil or hotter. And that really does take care of most of the risk. For example, hamburger. The thing that makes hamburger risky is that you take a piece of meat that is sterile on the inside but has some bacteria on the surface, and you grind it up, which means that you mix up the inside with the outside, and so you spread whatever bacteria were on the outside throughout the meat. And that's why it's advisable, although not wonderful for the texture of the hamburger, to cook it well all the way through, because the bacteria have been spread all the way through.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harold McGee, and he has a new edition of his popular book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. What do you think of broiling, like broiling steak?
Broiling works very well for very thin pieces of food. And the problem and the advantage both is that the broiler is very, very hot. So you get very high temperatures to develop at the surface of the food very quickly. That means that you develop flavor very quickly, and that's the appeal of grilled and broiled foods in general. The problem is that if the food takes more than a few minutes to cook through, then the outside is going to burn while the inside cooks through. And so there are a couple of ways you can deal with that. One is to broil the outside or grill the outside at a very high temperature very quickly to develop flavor, and then take it from the broiler or the grill and move it to a warm but not super hot place. So the oven or a part of the grill that is at a much lower temperature, and then let the interior cook through much more gently.
How much time should you marinate foods in order to take full advantage of the marinade?
Well, marination is something that, generally speaking, only affects the surface of the food. And in fact, the longer the marinade is in contact with the surface of the food, it's true that you get more flavor there, but you can also cause more damage to the structure of the surface. Marinades often contain wine, for example, and wine is acidic, and acids tend to break proteins down. If you leave a piece of meat in a wine marinade for more than a few hours, then the surface ends up kind of mealy because the acid breaks the protein down. And there's a difference, of course, between marinades and brines. Brine is maybe a particular kind of marinade, which is a certain salt concentration that ends up allowing the meat to retain more moisture when it cooks. In the case of a brine, it's important to leave the food in the brine long enough for the brine to penetrate into the food. And so you want meat to stay in a brine longer than you would want it to stay in an acidic marinade.
Harold McGee, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Harold McGee has written a revised edition of his 1984 book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.